Three, two, one. Hi, this is Chuck Anderson. Thanks for being with us and welcome to the show. Some time ago, I had Ted Becker on the show, and while he was attending a conference in Huron on Germans from Russia, I had a marvelous opportunity at the same conference on November 13th to meet Dr. Timothy Coburn-Dance, and I want to welcome you to the show right now, sir.
It's good to be here.
You also had the opportunity, and we're going to get to this in a little bit, of being in Russia in August 1991 when the Soviet Union actually collapsed. But we'll be getting back to that. Also, we have another PhD doctor on the staff here today, Dr. Harry Delker. And Harry, thanks for being with us, sir.
Well, I enjoy being here also.
Tim, you've authored a new book titled Thunder on the Steppe, which will be released soon. And can you tell us the date that we're looking for this release?
We're hoping that the book will be out on November the 22nd or 23rd, if we can keep to the production schedule, and I think we can. And it's a book written not only by myself, but also my wife, Rosalinda, who is a co-author. And she and I both made the trip to Russia in which we gathered so much information on present-day German life in the Volga region.
And on that trip, it's kind of interesting how you got to that trip. I was fortunate enough to hear your presentation at the conference here. You were turned down. You actually started in the early 80s trying to get over to do some research. What happened?
Well, that's right. We began applying for visas in 1984. And we were our visas were declined year after year until the summer of 1991, when it seemed as if we were destined to be in Russia. And so we prepared to leave in August of 1991, which of course turned out to be one of the most historic months in the Soviet Union's history, at least in this century. It's kind of funny because before we left, there were friends of ours who asked us, so aren't you afraid of going into Russia when things are still so unstable? And our response was, and we laughed a little bit about it, but we said, we're not going to worry unless there's something like a coup or if something happens to Gorbachev. In other words, we were trying to reduce that possibility to the level of the laughable in our own minds. And in fact, we joked with our children, our two young sons, Mike and Matt, before we left as well. And we said, you know, if there's a coup or something, you may have to learn the martial arts and come rescue us in a Siberian labor camp. And we'd all laugh about it.
Well, you're on the other side of the earth because you're a professor of anthropology and folklore at North Dakota State University. So you're all the way on the other side of the earth.
That's right. And so when we made these plans, we realized we were going into an area that in anthropology we call terra incognita. It was unknown land because so few Americans had visited that particular region. We didn't quite know what to expect. We did know beforehand that there were Germans living in the area we wanted to visit in the Volga region near the city of Saratov. Maps were very hard to come by that showed any detail of that particular region. But we did have some contacts, some people that we corresponded with, even though the mail, again, was rather uncertain as to making connections. But when we departed in August of 1991, we did have, I must admit, a funny feeling about it. And I do not say that now, you know, a couple of years later, but we weren't sure if it meant something happening to us or something happening to our two children whom we left behind, but we just had an uneasy feeling about it. And when we arrived in Russia, the village that we were aiming for, which was on the Volga River, it turned out to be wonderful. The people welcomed us with open arms. There was plenty of food, plenty of drink. But only a few days later, that would change when we heard that something had happened to Gorbachev. We were told there was a new Soviet constitution, and we saw a lot of troop movements, very sad-looking soldiers going from village to village. And then we tried to piece together what was happening, and of course later we would learn that a Soviet coup had occurred.
Without television or radio, in other words, that's reliable, without being censored, how did you know what was happening?
Well, on the second day of the coup, was when we heard from people in the summer kitchen, which was a little kitchen off from the main home where a lot of the cooking was done. The people in the summer kitchen had heard on a radio, a small transistor radio, that Gorbachev was ill and that things were going on in Moscow.
Oh, you know how Johnny Carson always joked about people that were told were ill in Russia. They always died.
Exactly, and that's how we felt. My first question to our host was, maybe Gorbachev is dead. What do you think? And the host just shook his head. You know, in Russia, who knows? Was pretty much what his expression told me. But he said, let's just wait until this evening, around 6 o'clock. Maybe there'll be some news. If not, at 9 o'clock, there will be the evening news that we can watch on television. Well, there was nothing at 6. At 9 o'clock, we were there with the members of that German family in the home waiting for the news, and all that was playing was an old Russian film. Then he said, let's turn to the other channel. Same old Russian film was playing on that channel. There was no news at all that evening. And then he and his wife and the other members of the family said, this is very bad. Something big has happened in Moscow.
No news means something big is happening
right.
in Russia.
Not no news is good news in Russia. It means things are happening and you'd better be cautious.
Were you aware that Yeltsin was trying to save this? Was his name being... You made a telephone call back to the States and you actually became kind of a free voice of Russia for a little bit.
That's right. On the third day of the coup, the afternoon, the uncertainty was simply getting to us. The people there accepted this because they said this is how it is in Russia. One must always wait. One waits in lines. One waits to hear what is happening in Moscow or even in the world, but one has to be patient. Well, my concern was if things were getting so out of hand in Moscow and throughout the Soviet Union, maybe my wife and I should then leave the country while things were not quite so hot, so we indeed could leave. So I needed more information. So I asked our host if I could make a phone call to the United States from the village there. He took me to the post office, and the reception was very cold. The people looked at us and said there would be no phone calls to the United States, then or ever. A woman who overheard us in the post office, however, a German woman who was sympathetic, she ran out into the street when we were leaving, and she told us that if we would hurry to another village about 10 miles away, she thought that our reception there might be better and we might be able to place the call. She was right. It took us hours, but we were able to call our relatives in Colorado where our children were staying, and we were given the news. My brother-in-law told me that there had been a coup in Russia. They did not know, even in the States at that time, what had happened to Gorbachev, but there had certainly been a coup. It looked like the military had taken over and that Americans were being advised by President Bush to leave the country, to leave Russia. I told my brother-in-law, I said, how are we going to leave? Moscow is the place we exit from. And that sounds like that's where everything is happening.
How many miles do you suspect you were from Moscow at that point?
500 miles, enough that people in the village there said a century ago, and they would still say, that Moscow and heaven are far away. All right? And that's pretty much how we felt. In some ways, we felt good, because if a lot of the real strife was going on in Moscow, that was better for us, but we felt that it might just filter down over the next few days, because there was real anti-German sentiment in the village in which we were staying. And the family there did everything they could to protect us. But I must say we did realize how bad it was getting by the fourth day of the coup, which was the last day, but news would not reach us until the fifth day, actually. But on the fourth day of the coup, our host family, the father and the mother, just out of the blue said, why don't we show you our cellar? They took us to an old farm shed, moved away several sacks of grain, and there was a concealed cellar. And then they had us climb down this rickety ladder to inspect the family cellar. And then they told us here, two people could live for a long time if they had to.
Wow. They're trying to tell you something, maybe?
Sure. Looking back now, it's pretty certain that they were looking out for us and thinking that they might be arrested for having Americans, but then maybe what they could tell authorities is the Americans had left already or something. I'm not sure, but I know looking in that cellar, I thought, I'm not going to stay here for long. I would probably take any other option. Who knows? That was one of the hardest things about that experience, was the uncertainty of it all. The terrible uncertainty. And I found out that as much as we may criticize the media in this country, it's still great to be able to turn on any radio channel, TV channel, at least hear something.
But, so our freedom of the press really becomes quite precious when you go through an experience like that.
Definitely. Definitely.
Even though they yell at us and sometimes they don't like us, but the fact is we still have a flow of free news. And we don't make the news, we just cover it.
That's right, that's right. And the people there in Russia seemed to feel the same way, because we told them how it was in America. And they said, too, well, then how do you tell what is true and what isn't true? And we said, well, that is America. You hear so many different points of view and you make up your mind. This was something, though, that struck their ears as a very strange concept. They hadn't lived with it. And realized that this wasn't only under communism, but in the Tsar's time, too, so long before, things also were very tight, very secretive. And so there really was not the tradition for democracy there. And in fact, the people told us, after the coup was over and we talked about what course Russia might take, they said, maybe what we need to do is to pattern ourselves after America and do just what you've done. And I said, well, maybe not. You need to go your own way. See where we have erred. See where we have made some mistakes. But Russia must chart its own course.
We're going to be back in just a minute. A wonderful guest, Dr. Timothy Klober dance, and I always want to make sure I get the names right. Am I saying it correctly, sir?
You're saying it right. In German, it would be Klober dance, but we settle for Klober dance.
Pretty close. Okay. We're going to be back in one moment. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. 3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson, my guest, Dr. Timothy Klober dance, and he's with North Dakota State University, a professor of anthropology and folklore. Also with us is Dr. Harry Delker. Am I saying that right, Harry?
That's correct.
Boy, we haven't had your voice on here much, but we've got a story that's going to knock the socks off the people when you get on here. And you're currently living right now with Aberdeen. You're a retired psychologist, and last place that you had been a professor was the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee.
That's correct, and an administrator in several settings between those times.
Timothy, we've taken you out of the sanctuary of the United States of America, and I guess travel makes us all very appreciative of this nation. You got to get away from it to appreciate what a wonderful country this is. You have given up all the security of North Dakota, USA. You've gone inland 500 miles from Moscow. You and your wife find yourself in the middle of a political coup, and you don't know what's going to happen. It worked out okay.
Yes, it did. And I know at the time that all this was going on, my wife and I would have changed places with anyone. It was that bad, particularly because of the uncertainty. But now, in retrospect, of course, we realize that the timing was perfect. We had tried for 7 years or more, and we couldn't have hit it any better in terms of wanting to find something out about the modern German Russians, their life today, and at a time when so much would change. It also was the 50th anniversary of the great Volga-German deportation, August 1941. And so when
we might mention that to the people right now, because that's interesting. Ted Becker mentioned that also.
Mm-hmm.
But if they haven't heard the first show, that's their fault, right, Tim?
That's right, that's right. When the deportation happened, this was a real blow, particularly to the Volga Germans of Russia, because this meant that their whole republic, some 500,000 people, were exiled within a matter of days to Siberia, to Kazakhstan, and also into the Altai, very remote areas of the former Soviet Union. It was, in many ways, the death of a nation, the death of a republic. And the people who had been there, who talked to us, they said that the sound of weeping, the sound of sad singing was something they would always recall, because they knew how final this was. The very word Siberia had a final sound, even in 1941. But this was the 50th anniversary when we were there, August of 1991, 50 years later. And so these memories were fresh in the people's minds. After the coup, when we talked to the people, and it looked like Soviet communism was collapsing, They saw justice in this. It had taken 50 years, half a century, but they felt that a system that was so evil, and that was their word for it, was finally collapsing, and that it was only all in God's good time. The people there were very devout, and this was something that surprised us because
devout.
Devout in terms of having very strong religious convictions, whether Roman Catholic or Lutheran. They told us that this is what brought them through the hard times.
Now, we were always told all of the decades that I could remember that religion was not allowed in Russia.
Well, that was pretty much the official policy, even though the Soviet Constitution had made allowances for religious worship and religious freedom. Still, this was problematic, to say it the most politely that I can. The people who wanted to worship freely there were simply not allowed to. And the hardest thing was to teach the young about religion, because this always led to some problems if others heard about it. But the people there told us that religion was really the one thing that brought them through the long Siberian sojourn. And because God was always at their side then, he would remain at their side even when times were better. And so we were very much struck by the devout nature of the people. And in fact, on the first day of the coup, which was August the 18th, 1991, it was a Sunday, we were at a church service. And on the way to that church service, one of the women had said that Gorbachev wasn't well liked in Russia, but Gorbachev had allowed the people to worship freely, and for that she would always be grateful. Now that's ironic, because that very evening is when Gorbachev would find all of his phones dead and his home surrounded by the KGB and the official beginning of the coup. Looking back now, that quote of the woman's has special significance.
I'm surprised, Dr. Tim. I always want to call you Dr. Tim. Ever since I've met you, I thought, that's a nice name. It's actually Timothy. I got to get my paper so I can say it right. Cloberdans. But Dr. Tim somehow has a nice ring. So if you hear me say Dr. Tim, I am surprised. I am surprised that there were 500,000 Germans left after visiting with Ted Becker, who said the pact that Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin went together and made in 1938 and consummated by 1940 had, actually it was a deal, I'm sure you're aware of this, the deal was Hitler wanted his Germans back out of Russia so he could put them in the factories and on the farms and make them do the work. And he told Stalin, what a good deal, because you guys can keep the farms and you can keep the livestock and all that, and we'll cheat them all out of it. Well, they moved somewhat like 1.5 to 3 million Germans, according to what Ted had said on our earlier broadcast. I'm surprised there were 500,000 left, Tim.
This is because these people, the 500,000, were in the Volga area. The others, of course, were in the Black Sea region primarily, and also in the area of Bessarabia, where so many were allowed to return to Germany. But in the Volga area, the security was much tighter there. And one of the reasons was that the Russians feared, and rightly so, that if the Nazis invaded, the crossing the Volga would really spell whether Russia would be successful or not in resisting the Nazi advance. So these Volga Germans living on the Volga, you can imagine what kind of a spot they were in. The security was tight, but then after the invasion of Russia in the summer of 1941, by August, plans were made to deport the whole republic. And this was done, of course, without any kind of Volga German input. It was done, according to Soviet authorities at the time in the KGB, for their safety. In other words, that as these Nazis approached, maybe the Volga Germans would be caught in the crossfire. Well, the Volga Germans understood what was going on. They were being deported, lock, stock, and barrel. It's interesting, I met a few years ago a Israeli scholar, a man from Jerusalem, who told me that as a boy he had witnessed the Volga German deportation because he and his grandmother were living in the city of Saratov. Hmm. And he said that he would never forget the sight of thousands of people going from these village areas to railway stations, and all of these men in green coats and carrying machine guns. And he asked his mother, who were the men in the green coats? And she said, KGB. In other words, KGB was pretty much organizing the Volga German deportation.
Wow.
The people were sent into Siberia with very little advance warning, so that they did not take much warm clothing with them, food preserves, and so the loss of life was just monumental. And everyone was sent to Siberia, even Communist Party members of the Communist Youth League. everyone. And it was analogous to what happened to Japanese Americans in this country, with two important exceptions, and that is the Japanese Americans here did not have the brutal treatment that Germans did. Theirs was harsh enough, but it wasn't brutal in terms of the number of lives that were lost. And secondly, the Japanese Americans were allowed to return home. The Volga Germans were not, and even to this day have not been given the official okay.
I want to ask you how you arrived at the title of your new book, which will be released soon, Thunder of the Steppe.
That title stems from an experience that we had in Russia that, when we think about, still gives us goosebumps. On the third day of the coup, we accompanied the people out on the Russian steppe, and they wanted to show us the sites of their former villages, villages that had been bulldozed by the communists. They told us there wouldn't be much to see, only a few mounds, a few trees maybe that marked where the church was, but they wanted us to see what was home to them. And so they hired a bus driver, and we had a small bus crammed full of elderly German-Russian people. We went out onto the steppe, and the bus driver would call out the name of the colony as if we were in a big metropolitan area, but he would call out the name of the colony, and people would get off. And you could see very little, but it was very emotional for them. They would go over to the place where their home once was. There was only maybe a mound there or some weeds, and they would stand there. They'd cry. They'd pray. But always asking in German, warum, why, why? In other words, why had these villages been bulldozed? Why had these people been sent to Siberia? They were still trying to make sense of it these many years later. But then there came a point at which we visited one particular village. In fact, it was the village which was the home village of both my wife and myself in Russia. It was the village of Rothammel, which in English means the Red Ram. And we stopped at that village, and the people went to the cemetery, which had been desecrated. There were only a few markers left.
I found that interesting in your speech today. They wanted to erase you so bad, they bulldozed the cities and even destroyed the grave markers.
Right, as many as they could. The few that remained were usually iron crosses.
They wanted to erase you.
Right, and from history, because even the great Soviet encyclopedia after 1941 made no mention of Germans in Russia, although they mentioned other minorities. But they did. They wanted to erase the people from the face of the earth as well as from the history books.
And now it's parched.
That's right. And at that particular village site, a lot of the people were from Rothammel, from that particular colony. And they went over to the cemetery, and they sang a song known as Dashiksal, which is a song you sing for the dead, to remember the dead. They also sang a song for peace. And then an older woman said to us, now we're going to sing a song that we don't often sing, and it is very powerful. It's a song for rain. It hasn't rained here for months. So she started the song, and the other people, they chimed right in. They sang this very powerful song. In English, it would be something like, God, you up there in heaven, look down on your children. Show some sign of your mercy. Send rain. Let us have a good harvest. But a very moving song. I'd seen this song in books, but I'd never heard it before. And indeed, it was a powerful melody, and the people sang it with every ounce of emotion and feeling. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. Later that day, we visited a few more villages, and sure enough, there was thunder on the steppe that evening.
And as your pictures showed, there was rain in the streets.
There was rain in the streets. The people's prayers had been answered.
What a wonderful guest, Dr. Timothy Kloberdance. And we're going to visit with Dr. Harry Delker in just a moment. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. 3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson, our guest, our Dr. Timothy Kloberdance, Dr. Harry Delker from Aberdeen. And also I want to introduce our wonderful, very efficient production engineer who's helping me today is Michael Kloberdance. Michael is 15 and studying German, I understand.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you say hello to you people here in South Dakota in German? And this is going to be tough because this is what, your first or second year of German?
Second.
Okay.
Guten Tag.
He's looking at his dad.
Liebe Leute.
Liebe Leute.
Yeah.
I'm the only guy that doesn't speak German at this whole table. And I want to mention, I want to thank very much the Crossroads Hotel and Convention Center in downtown Huron for giving us the facilities of this beautiful ballroom. The conference is over, and we're just sitting here in this big, beautiful ballroom all by ourselves. Harry, you mentioned something that, as a journalist, it boggled my mind today. And I said, we have got to get this on the show. It goes back to the Eureka, South Dakota area. We're going to set the time. We're going to stage it during World War I. This is incredible. Tell us about it, please.
If I can just set the stage for a moment, because what it deals with is the anti-German sentiment. And if I might add one more note, many of us spoke German as kids. My example is, I'm told that I spoke German for 2 years before I ever learned a word of English. Then going through school, and you're right, I was born and raised in Eureka, South Dakota. And I'm sure what I'm describing will be typical of many other communities that were predominantly German-Russian in terms of the ethnic group. At any rate, I recognized clear through my public school education that for whatever reason, I was only to speak German to certain people, like good friends or my relatives, and only those relatives you trusted. And that's just sort of an impression. And consequently, I didn't maintain the facility of carrying on a good conversation in German. And I never did understand, and it took me years, and I'm still trying to learn, but in more recent years, I was exploring why didn't I learn to maintain my facility with the language, the German language. And so what you were asking bears on that point, and that is that most of it begins with the notion of the extreme anti-German sentiment, particularly in World War I. There was some of that certainly in World War II, but it was much worse in World War I. And the incident that I shared with you when we talked earlier dealt with the fact that there was indeed a law, and I don't recall if it was an actual law that was legislated, but had the force of law, at any rate, that there will be no German speaking in public. And then when you think about that, the practical applications were meant you could not speak German on the telephone because there were public telephone lines, party lines. And most significant, of course, you couldn't give speeches in German. And because most of the churches at that time were German congregations, you could not hold service in German in the churches of Eureka. And I speak only of Eureka because I know that story better. I'd be interested to learn in how many other communities this had been happening. I'm sure it was rather prevalent.
And this story, let us add, is documented with at least 7 different research sources.
That's correct. And I might add, to give the gentleman credit, I think Dr. Anthony Richter, a professor at SDSU, has some of the best documentation. Many people are aware of this story and incidents like this.
I wasn't, though.
Okay. Yeah, many weren't. And many people in Eureka are not. So very often we're surprised that people that live in a community are not aware of what happened in their rather recent history. At any rate, the ultimate unbelievable incident is the fact that not only was this forbidden, federal agency or people that functioned with the force of federal law came in and padlocked the churches of Eureka.
Wow.
And so sometimes we forget that what we think of as our freedoms from time to time get trampled upon rather severely. And this is one of those rather unusual examples that people still don't know enough about, because we tend not to talk about our mistakes of the past that don't get the same publicity that some of the very good things that we're all proud of.
Let's switch real fast. Tim, you're scholarly and worldly. Have you heard stories like this?
Yes, from many, many people in the Plain States, as well as in my own hometown in Colorado, where there were also similar experiences. There were burnings of German hymnals on the part of the English-speaking community. Also, German-speaking people forced to kneel and kiss the American flag as a public display. Also, names were changed. For instance, we had a little town of Amon, Colorado, which was named after a German-Russian pioneer. That was suddenly changed to the town of Logan, and that name, of course, remains. But the hardest thing, I think, was that the German-Russian people, when they came to this country in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they kept trying to make a point of the fact that they were German. They were German-speaking, and their heritage was German, even though they came from Russia. That just didn't sink in for some reason. Many people looking at them, the women in their head shawls, the men in their Russian caps and fur coats, always considered them Russians. By the time that it did sink in that they were German, it was World War I. Terrible timing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, many German Russians said, although we're German, realize that we came from Russia. I mean, they were always being straight about it. And yet this would be misinterpreted in various ways. But there were similar experiences. There was even a lynching in the Midwest of a German-American man. And these things, of course, made it in the news. It scared a lot of German-speaking people. And I think that the German-Russian community in America to this day still is having to deal with that painful experience during the First World War, as many years ago as it was. I know that from talking to the older people who experienced it. I talked to one woman who told me that she will never forget that day in 1918 when she went to the German school and the teacher was not there. And then they were told by somebody else who came in that there would be no more German school. And she said that that hurt her so much because she loved this country. She loved the freedom of this country. But in 1918, as many German-speaking people who lived through it will attest.
Harry, I understand during this period that even German newspapers were shut down.
Well, they were shut down in a little different way than you might assume. They were shut down in the sense that there was a requirement, a federal requirement, that everything that's printed as news be appear in the English language right next to it on the same paper. Now, if you can imagine, I mean, that's tantamount shutting them down. And the only one that can approve that was a federal agent. The only federal agent in the community was the postmaster. In practical terms, a newspaper publisher had to go to the postmaster, prove that he had an exact translation right next to it in the paper, and that would be a way of accommodating the law. It's practically impossible to do. So as a result of that, many newspapers went out of business because they couldn't function and make that application work. And if I may just mention one newspaper in particular, the Dakota Fire Press.
Yeah.
I won't get into the whole history. It started in Yankton, but it was located in Aberdeen, South Dakota, from 1909 through 1920, and later moved to New Ulm, and it was finally closed down editorially and completely in 1954. But the significance is that there's so many interesting facets of that paper and those publishers, the Sollett family. And Friedrich Wilhelm Sollett was the man who initiated this paper and was the editor and publisher. And he was taken to court as an enemy alien for having violated. It was a technical violation. He didn't get one of those paragraphs in on a certain story. To this day, we can't tell that there was any news significance in terms of war news that was related to the story in the first place. However, he was taken to court, and the judge was sympathetic, knew of the man's reputation. But under the law, in essence, the judge said, we know what a fine man you are and your excellent reputation.
They have television stations now in Spanish. They have radio stations. You go anywhere in the West and the Southwest, you have Spanish-speaking everything. In that day, they would have all been arrested or shut down or closed or put off the air.
Well, not that day, but it takes a little more time, but, you know, maybe a couple of weeks. And as a matter of fact, he had two newspapers. The other one was a Neue Deutsche Presse out of the same building, and that paper was primarily for the Germans from Germany, Empire Germans. And that one ultimately folded just because of lack of subscription that were number of subscribers, actually. And so the subscribers went down and they folded. This paper carried on longer. But certainly, there's a whole history of fascinating information. I do want people to know that we have a historical marker in Aberdeen, South Dakota. It's located at the intersection of Dakota Street and 6th Avenue, Highway 12. And they can read a little bit about there. There's also a free brochure describing this project, the man, and the paper that's available free of charge if they contact the Aberdeen Chamber of Commerce, Germans from Russia Heritage Society in Bismarck, or the American Historical Society for Germans from Russia out of Lincoln, Nebraska. And so it's an important story, an important paper.
When these churches were padlocked because they just simply gave a sermon in German instead of English, what was the reaction from the other ministers? Why didn't somebody, you know, say, hey, we have certain constitutional freedoms in the United States? Or was there apathy by other pastors?
There might have been fear. And to answer your question, you're going to get into a whole new ballpark of things. I'll give you an example, though. Those that tried to fight back and resist, the first thing they were doing was at the head of a list in which they had more problems they faced. And I can talk about that a little more if you like.
We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson.
Okay, but remember where we left.
3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson. I want to thank everyone out there on I-90, I-29, our listeners from Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska. It's a fascinating show, and I'm glad that you've stayed with us during the show. This is our last segment. I want to remind everyone that's just tuned in right now. Our guests are Dr. Timothy Cloberdance and Dr. Harry Delker. And if I get it right, Doc?
That's correct.
I'm surrounded by intellectuals here.
Originally, it was Dolker, and my relatives, whom I've just discovered in the last 3 years, are still spelling it D-O instead of D-E. So it's same name, same relative, different spelling in this country.
Harry is a retired psychologist, and Tim is still an active professor at North Dakota State University. Let's get back now. The question was, Harry, did the other pastors look in horror at churches right here in South Dakota being padlocked, or was there remorse, or did they just do nothing?
I don't know that I can address accurately what the other pastor did precisely, but I do know that those that resisted had more troubles befall them, even beyond the things we were talking about. There's a whole other history of they were forced to buy war bonds, and to the extent where they would have to literally mortgage property under duress to buy these, what they call the Liberty Bonds. And it's, with reference specifically to the ministers, I don't know. And I'd be interested in a moment if you'd ask Tim the same question. Sure. He might have some impression. But I do want to indicate that two things we have to keep in mind. One is when there is a lot of duress and pressure, there is not the freedom to do it to begin with, number one. Number two, you'd be surprised how unbrave people can be when it really means sticking your neck out to try to force an issue that deals with some of our freedoms. But maybe Tim has some response.
Oh, no, I agree completely. And a little sadly, too. My own feeling is that one of the reasons other ministers did not speak out more loudly and boldly in defense of the German ministers and the German congregations is because in World War I, it was not only an attack on the German-speaking population, but on all quote-unquote foreigners. There were ministers who used Norwegian and Swedish in church who also decided to drop the language at that time, fearing that there was much more to this than just a fear of German loyalties in this country, but loyalties to the old world.
How quick a democracy can be. Yeah, I mean, this is just making me sad listening to this, Doc.
Yes, in North Dakota, I've interviewed older Norwegians who told me that they were afraid in 1918 of some of the things that might befall them, seeing what went on in German communities, because they knew those German people not to be unpatriotic. They were good, hardworking, ordinary citizens, but overnight, then suddenly, there was this black cloud over them. And I think it made perhaps a number of immigrants think twice about some of the things that they had taken for granted in this country.
What a premise for a movie. How come they haven't used a premise like this? This should be just shocking since it actually happened right here in the United States. And not only the United States, but South Dakota.
Oh, but I think the most dramatic story that I know of that took place here in South Dakota.
At Parkston?
Yes, in the, near the Parkston area. Was also again in that year, 1918, when one of the groups that was singled out was none other than the Hutterites, because the Hutterites were not only German-speaking, they lived in colonies, they were communal, which is something that people did not quite understand in the early 1900s. People were rather suspicious of the Hutterites, but one of the things that really bothered them was the Hutterite stance on pacifism. The Hutterites were peace-loving. They had left Russia, in fact, because they did not want to serve in the Russian military. They had left Germany and Austria and other countries before that because they always felt very strongly about pacifism. In 1918, the Hutterite young men were called up to serve in this country's military, and the Hutterites saw no problem in serving their country, but not in a militaristic sort of way. They would not wear a uniform, and they would not carry a gun. For some reason, four young Hutterites from a colony near Parkston were singled out. And the authorities felt that if they could just break the will of those four, maybe other Hutterite men would follow in line.
Around the nation.
Right. In 1918, those four men were ordered. They had passed their physical, and then they were ordered to put on a uniform. And they refused. They said that this was not to be done, because this was something that went completely against Hutterite teachings and the teachings they had been brought up with from the time they were very small children. They were sent to Fort Lewis in Washington, and there they were unable to break their spirit, and so they decided they would send them to the Rock, to Alcatraz, military prison there. Those four Hutterites were in the prison there for 4 months, and in fact, they were treated in ways that led to their physical demise. Their clothing was taken away. They were thrown into the equivalent of a dungeon at Alcatraz. They were denied water and food, and they were told again and again, unless you give in, unless you put on a uniform, you're going to die. Well, these Hutterites come from a people who have a long history of persecution. Undoubtedly, they sang some of the same hymns their ancestors had sung at the time of persecution, but they had something that sustained them. But after 4 months, the men were very weak, and they decided to transfer them from Alcatraz to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The train ride was a very long one. They had been through a lot, so that by the time they reached Fort Leavenworth, two of the young Hutterites were in very bad shape. And in fact, they telegrammed for their wives to come and see them, because they feared that one of the men or more might die. When the wives finally were able to get to Fort Leavenworth, they were told that the men were in bad shape in terms of their physical health. But one woman was very persistent, wanted to see her husband immediately, and she was taken to a room in which there was a coffin, and in that coffin was her husband in uniform. This was a terrible blow to this woman. She had asked if this was the man's request, and the authorities had to admit that it was not, that they put the uniform on a dead body, because this man had refused to wear it so long as he was breathing. Shortly after, another Hutterite man died at Fort Leavenworth. And when these bodies were returned to the Hutterite colony near Parkston, it was the occasion of a huge funeral. And the Hutterites again sang the songs of persecution. And that is really what led to the great exodus from South Dakota of so many Hutterites to Canada. And it was not until then, the 1930s, the Depression era, when, interestingly enough, authorities from South Dakota and others would go to Canada and ask, and even in some cases, the way it sounds, beg the Hutterites to return. And there were those Hutterites who decided to forgive and forget and return to South Dakota. There were others that were not necessarily unforgiving, but they simply felt that Canada was there at a time when they needed it, in 1918, and they would continue to live and work in Canada.
Yeah, two quick things on that point, if I may. My understanding is that the second body that was returned, shipped back to the colonies, was also in uniform. And Tim is nodding yes, correct. The other thing is that we shouldn't forget that about the time, or just prior to the Hutterites moving to Canada, South Dakota, at least, had also withdrawn their ability to remain incorporated, which just jerked the rug from out from under them. So we made it impossible for them to stay. The only colony that stayed were the original mother colony, Bonham Colony. And the other point I wanted to add, though, if I may, is that when we're talking about the freedoms we take for granted, we should never forget that those have been violated and be very aware of those exceptions when we see them. During the dedication of this historical marker I was referring to that exists in Aberdeen, at which Dr. Laverne Ripley was a featured speaker, and we also had a second speaker by the name of Harold Higgins, who was a publisher of the Aberdeen American News at the time. He now has moved to the same position in Boulder, Colorado. But if I may, he spoke about the events that were created to stimulate this German fear during World War I, and the extent to which officials would go to throttle the German language press. And if I may, I'd like to quote about two sentences from that speech. "Controlling the media," Higgins says, "is the primary course of action for any government that wants to control the minds of the public. It is the first tactic of communist countries and dictators alike, and it is, in fact, a tactic of even well-meaning government officials in our own sterling democracy. And we've seen that throughout history of our own country," end quote.
I think if any student of journalism right now is listening, or certainly a seasoned journalist, a news reporter, they must just almost be shuddering in their tracks to think this did happen in the United States.
Yes, and you don't have time, but there are other stories that you may wish to pursue on future programs that are just as dramatic, and perhaps even more so, that relate to the unbelievable or the things that we don't know about, almost the untold stories to date.
I am.
And I just want to add one footnote. Yes. I do appreciate and agree with the importance and the freedom of the press, how important it is, but there are some stories in which the very protectors have let us down. I did a TV program one time called "Who's the Watchdog for the Media?" And there are some stories in which the media, totally, has to assume some major responsibility because they weren't willing to pursue stories that were significant and important to the citizens of an area or a country.
Did the media cover the closing of this German-written newspaper?
I don't know. I'd have to check on that. Yes, certainly they did, because he was in court. And, in fact, the reason I know what I do about it, besides what was researched by Dr. Ripley, was I did my own research and found original microfilm stories of the time from Aberdeen and area papers that covered the incidents as well as the trial.
Harry, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Dr. Harry, I don't know why I'm having trouble with Delker. It's so easy. Why am I having trouble with Delker? But Dr. Harry Delker, retired psychiatrist.
Because you had trouble with Dr. Tim, too.
Maybe it's the Swede in here with all of the germs in it. It's not coming right through. I really appreciate you being with us. I'll bet you were one real fine professor to have had back in those years, and I'm sorry that I was not able to have taken one of your classes. And Dr. Timothy Kloberdatz.
Dr. Tim.
Dr. Tim.
Now I'm saying it.
Now you are still, that's right, might be catching. When you go back to North Dakota State University, of course, you are still a professor, and I sure would like to be able to take a class from you. I want to thank you very much for being on the show.
You bet. And just as another footnote, too, I have a number of students who call me Dr. Tim. They don't feel comfortable calling me Tim, but Dr. Tim I'll settle for. And you drop in anytime you want, Chuck. I know the students there would have something to learn from you, and who knows? You might be able to really be able to tell us a number of things, too.
Well, hey, you were gracious enough to let our South Dakota State University beat you guys this fall, and we appreciate that very much.
Dr. Tim, you're a real credit to your university, and I personally think North Dakota should be very proud to have you on their faculty. I want to thank all my guests for being on the show today. Dr. Timothy Kloberdatz, Professor of Anthropology and Folklore with the North Dakota State University, and Dr. Harry Delker, psychologist and retired professor with the University of Wisconsin, who now lives in Aberdeen. To our listeners, we always want to thank you
for tuning us in every Saturday morning on this station where we follow the world news at 10 o'clock. From our studios at KIJV and here in South Dakota, this is Chuck Anderson saying, have a great and successful week. Bye for now.